Shalom and welcome to Wisdom and Torah Ministries. It's an honor and a privilege to be with you again. I am so delighted because, you know, we've been learning a lot about the ancient Near East and the concept of covenant. You know, one of the things that I really believe you and I need to remember is that the word of Yahweh is eternal and forever. You know, we need to know that as we continue to work on the principles of the Torah, that we are going to be able to understand long-term all the basic principles that the Bible speaks about. Now, I got to let you know, every teaching that I've had is all in regards to questions that I've had in my past and doubts that I had in my past, whether about Torah, whether about, you know, because we're learning as we go. And there are many questions that surface every time we do studies. And I began to do research, just trying to figure out, you know, what is exactly how to understand this from a Hebraic perspective. And, you know, what I'm finding out is, as I'm doing these teachings, I'm understanding that every question that I've had ever has been answered. Every kind of doubt that I had in regards to the text, reconciling the text in the first century writings, everything's being reconciled. Why? Because we're going back to the root. We're going back to the original understanding of Scripture during the time in which Moses received the Torah. Now, that is imperative that we remember, because as we continue our studies, there are many issues. Let me give you an example. There's a prophecy, and I will cover this later on, in one of the subtopics on this topic, is the line of Jeconiah, which was the king of Judah. In the book of Jeremiah, anti-missionaries used this text in order to prove that Yeshua cannot be the Messiah of the line of David. Why? Because it says, Yahweh said that no children of the sons of Jeconiah would ever rule in Jerusalem at all as kings. Well, you know that did happen. None of his children ruled in Jerusalem as king. Only his grandson, Zerubbabel, was able to be a vassal governor to the Persian king. Well, guess what? He was not a king of Israel. He was an appointed vassal governor or an appointee when they returned to the land of Israel under the Persian authority. So what does that tell you? It tells you that the moment that happened and they returned to the land, and now they're able to establish the Hasmonean family when they took over, after Ezra and Nehemiah, the Hasmonean family, during the Antiochus Epiphanes, they were not from the line of David. They were Levitical. So that prophecy did came true, that there will be no king ruling from the line of David. Until Yeshua. Yeshua is the son of Joseph, and now he was adopted by Joseph, and the moment Joseph calls him his son, or they addressed him in the New Testament as the son of Joseph, that is a language of adoption. But more so when Yeshua is in the River Jordan and the Heavenly Father says about him, this is my son whom I'm well pleased. The moment he calls him his son, that is a legal term of adoption in regards to a grant because of the loyal service of Yeshua will do for him. Now the Father has adopted him as a legal term in front of witnesses. And that's why all the disciples of John the Baptist went with him. Now, we know Yeshua is the son of the living God. We know that he's the image of the invisible God. But the Father used a legal term of the ancient Near East to establish the authority of his son on the earth. That is a very important point that has to do with the legal ramifications of the ancient Near East. It has nothing to do with theology. It's all about legal rights of the Torah in regards to the kingdom. Now, this little information like this allows us that when an anti-missionary comes in and tries to debate about Yeshua and the so-called mistakes in the New Testament, we can go and answer them in a manner that they themselves are not really addressing, because they're not addressing the scriptures from an ancient Near East perspective or a legal term. They're addressing it from a dogmatic theological position, just like Christianity does. So we're trying to place that understanding in the middle of all this, so we're able to understand about the wonderful works of Yahweh. Now, today's teaching is going to be about the grant covenants. Now, I've covered some of it already on my website, basically, about the background of the Suzerain Vassal Treaty and the background of the Parity Treaty. But today we're covering one isolated particular covenant, and we're dealing with, specifically, with the grant of the land. Why? Because we have to understand that the Bible is all about the land. Starts with the garden, right? And two trees. The tree of good and evil and the tree of life. Now, you know the Torah is called the Et Chaim, which is the tree of life. And now we know that right now in this world, we're dealing with two trees, the Christmas tree and the tree of life, the Torah. It's always a decision between one of the both. If you talk to a Christian brother in the system of religion, he has to make a decision whether I'm going to eat of the good side of the good tree, of the tree of good and evil, or am I going to eat of the tree of life. Now remember that we're talking about redemption is freely given to those who believe. You know, Yeshua came to do the work of redemption and reconciliation and salvation. But we still have to choose which tree we're going to eat from. Are we going to eat of the tree of good and evil, or are we going to eat of the tree of life? I choose to eat of the tree of life. Now, you know that throughout the Bible, it's all about a land, like Brad Scott says. It's about the land, a family, and a piece of and a house. About the house, a family, and a piece of land. Now, we know that the family is the family of God. And we know that the land is the land of Israel. And we know also that it's all about a tree, choosing to live. Now you notice that there are two trees in the garden, in the garden in Eden, in Genesis. But there's only one tree in the book of Revelation. And the book of Revelation is about the tree of life. This time you don't get to choose what you want to do. This time you're going to be submitted to the rule of your great suzerain, Yahweh, the Lord of hosts, and Yeshua, our Messiah. All right. So today we're going to talk about the grand covenant of our suzerain, the Near Eastern perspective of the royal grants of covenants on the ancient world. Now, there are three types of grants. There are many, but in this case, we're going to be focusing on three. We have the land grants, the priestly grants, and the kingship, the dynasty. Now, the kingship was given to David. David received the land and the kingship as a free will from the father, as a gift from the king, excuse me, in order for him to have an inheritance forever due to his good service and being loyal, because he desired to build the house for the Creator. By the way, no one can take those gifts away. Once the land is given to them, or the kingship is given to David, no one can take it away. We also have the grant of the priesthood. Now, the priesthood was a free grant that he gave to the Levites based on their service and their willingness to be obedient to the commandments. So therefore, now you have the grant of the priest, the grant of the kingdom, one to David, one to Levites, and then Pinchas. Then you have the grant of the land, which was given to Abraham, right? And what we're going to do, we're going to talk about those three grants, excuse me, but then we're going to take it all the way to the New Testament, to the first century writings, and see what Yeshua came to do for us, what kind of grant he gave us. The book of Revelation. We're going to take the seven churches of the book of Revelation and talk about the grants that are given there for those who overcome. First, you got to remember the book of Revelation is a covenant lawsuit against the children of Israel and the congregation for disobedience. It's all about a bride who is defiled, who's trying to bring restoration. There's a very interesting point that I need to be aware, that make you aware, that this is the context of the ancient Near East in light of the book of Revelation, so you understand where we're coming from. You notice that in the book of Revelation, there are the martyrs, those who are beheaded for the cause of the gospel. They're called martyrs for the gospel. And I've always wondered, why is beheading so prevalent in the book of Revelation? Until I begin to look into the ancient Near East. Now, we know that the Muslims, right now, they behead the enemy, the infidels. Now, that's very important because by understanding culture, we know who the Antichrist system, the army of the Antichrist system is, based on the preserving some of the ancient ways. What do the Muslims do when they go to Africa? They cut the limbs and they cut the heads of the infidels, those who do not want to submit to their pagan god. That is a sign of victory to them. Did you know that in the ancient Near East, a sign of victory was to cut the head or the hands of the enemy and bring it and send it to the people that they serve so that the people will see your king is dead. Now you submit to me. It's a sign of power and victory. Now let me give you a few examples of this. Samuel. When Samuel was told by Yahweh to tell King Saul that the king of the Amalekites, to destroy everything and to kill them, Saul preserved the king of the Amalekites. And when Samuel heard of it, he came in and he grabbed his sword and he cut the head off the king of the Amalekites. Why did he do that? Because that's an enemy of Yahweh. And Saul, Prophet Samuel, he followed through and showed victory to Yahweh. That's the way it was done. Now you also get an example of David. When David saw Goliath and he says, "Who is this uncircumcised on whom you're afraid?" What did he do? He threw a stone between his eyes, and then he took his sword and he cut the head off. Sign of victory. And you notice that's why the Philistines ran away. That means that the God of Israel is greater than the God of the Philistines. Also, you see in Gideon, and his mighty 300 men, what happened? He went through a city and he wanted food from the city, hospitality from that city to his mighty men. And the leadership in that community told him, "Have you brought us the hands of Saba and Salmuna in order for us to do this?" Well, what does that mean? If you read it from the English Western mindset, you're thinking, why would they want their hands? Well, what did Gideon do? He made an oath and he says, "I will do this, I will get the hands, and I'll go and get you too." And that's exactly what happened. He brought the hands of the enemy and he let them know, "Hey, victory. I got the victory. Now I'm going to take care of you for not extending hospitality." Now you got an answer from the book of Revelation in regards to why in the Great Tribulation the enemy of the Antichrist, which is us, will use his army, in my opinion, the Islamic Revolution, the seed of the enemy, to come and try to proclaim victory against the army of Yahweh. And now you have an idea of the context of the book of Revelation. So now that I gave you that insight, let's go into our teaching on the book of the Grand Covenants. Now, as you see on the screen, you're going to see a map of an ancient map, and it's the best one that I could find, of what is called the Royal Grant, the Land Covenant. Remember that we're going to cover the Grand Covenant of the land from the Father to Abraham, but it was a promised land. I will take you to the land that I will show you. The promised land to who? That I believe that the land of Israel is the original garden in Eden. You see, the Bible in the book of Genesis says that there was the garden, there was Eden, and that he put a garden in Eden. And inside the garden, he placed the man. I believe that the land given to Abraham is the land that Yahweh gave to his forefathers, Adam, and that because Abraham obeyed and he was a direct descendant of Adam, he gave that land he once promised to Adam. He gave it to Abraham and his seed forever. No one can take it away. So what we have done, we have traced the land of Abraham, given to Abraham, that it was already given to Adam. And because of the flood and the typography change, now he is trying to restore. God is trying to restore through that one man, Abraham, all the original promise given to Adam in the beginning. It's very fascinating because now you see how Yahweh never changes. And you see those patterns all through Scripture. Genesis, in the book of Exodus, is all about redeeming them from the dispersion to bring them to the land given to Abraham that was given to Adam and before. And then you see when they go through the wilderness, it's all about entering the land. And in the dispersion, for not keeping the commandments in the land, the gift, then he leaves them into the dispersion, the exiles. But he must bring them back to the land in order for his name to be exalted among the nations. Why is that? It's all about the land. You have to restore the land, to restore the house, to restore the people, and to restore the covenant. All those things go together. Okay? So in the Christian system of religion, now understand, I'm not talking about the people. I'm talking about the system of dogma. The religious systems, they accept one of those three. They accept the Davidic kingdom, that Yeshua must return in the land of David. I agree with that. Okay? But they disregard the land, because in the context of Christianity, they're going to heaven. They're not going to be in the land of Israel. So they disregard the land of Israel, and they basically say, we're going to go to heaven. But what does the Bible say in the book of Revelation? In Revelation chapter 5, verse 9 and 10 says this, "And they sang a new song, saying, you are worthy to take the scroll and to open its seal. And it says, for you were slain, and you have redeemed us to God by your blood out of every tribe and tongue and people and nation. You have made us kings and priests to Elohim, to our God, and we shall reign on the earth. So the book of Revelation tells us specifically where we're going to be. In Isaiah, it tells us from one Sabbath to one Sabbath, from one new moon to one new moon, we will be here. The book of Ezekiel talks about that we will be in the land. Ezekiel 16, Ezekiel 36, Ezekiel 37, the book of Jeremiah, Deuteronomy chapter 30 tells us he's going to take us to the land. So I do not understand why is it that in the systems of religion they accept Yeshua as the Davidic kingdom, but they are disregarding the land, which is an unconditional gift to Abraham from the Father. And if we say that God will not take us to the land, we are calling his gift to none effect and we're calling him a liar. And this is very important we remember not to do. We must believe in the covenant. We must believe in his promises. We must believe that he will give us the land that he promised to our forefather. Because if he doesn't, then his name will be taken for shame. His name will be brought to nothing. And now his name will be profaned among the nations. So this is imperative that we get a greater understanding of this. And please go to Israel. Spend time going to the land. Show, be like the spies, the 10 spies. I mean the 12 spies, but be like Joshua and Caleb. Make sure you bring a positive report. Because if you speak ill or speak wrongly against the land of Israel or against the people, you are no longer fighting against the people. You are fighting against the Creator who created the world, who established his sovereignty, who gave the land as a gift. So in fact, if you speak against the land, you're speaking against the giver of the land, and he will take issue with you. So in the screen, what you see is the original borders, roughly, I believe that the southern part covered all the way to the River Nile. It was a very wide area. I think it covers all the way Sinai Peninsula, all the way down to the River Nile, all the way north, but it's a very, very big piece of land. Now, I believe that the garden was inside that grant land that God gave. Why? For his good service. And we're going to cover more on this as we go along. What does the word heritage mean in Hebrew? Moashav. Moashah means possession, heritage, inheritance or possession. Okay, where do we see an example of those words? In Jeremiah chapters 2, verse 4, all the way, verse 4, and it says 5, 6, and 7. Says, hear ye with the word of the Lord, O house of Jacob, and all the families of the house of Israel. Thus says Yahweh, what unrighteousness have your fathers found in me, that they have gone far from me, and have walked after vanity and become vain, walked after other gods? Neither they say, where is Yahweh who brought us up from the land of Egypt, who led us through the wilderness, through a land of desert and of pits, through a land of drought and a shadow of death, through a land that none passed through, where no man lived? I brought you into a plentiful land to eat the fruit of it and the goodness of it. Remember the fruit of it. There was fruit in the garden of the tree of life. So therefore, he's making a connection to the original land. Says, and the goodness of it. But when you enter, you defiled my land and made my heritage an abomination. So here we see the attributes of the Creator of providing for us for our service. And then when we go in, we do not appreciate what he gave us, and we profane his land. All right? Another example of that is in Jeremiah chapter 3, verse 14 and 15, 16. Return, Bastleton Israel, says Yahweh, for I am a husband to you, and I will take you, one of a city and two of a family, and I will bring you to Zion. I will give you a shepherd according to my hearts. And you shall feed you, who shall feed you with knowledge and understanding. It shall come to pass when you are multiplied and increased in the land in those days, says Yahweh. They shall say no more, the ark of the covenant of Yahweh, neither shall they come to mind, neither shall they remember it, neither shall they miss it, neither shall they be made any more. In other words, he will bring you to Zion. Why is it so significant that he bring you to the land? Because the moment you come back to the land, you just declare that the sovereignty and the honor and the integrity of his word is established forever. So what happened in 1948 when the land of Israel was reestablished for the first time in 2,000 years and Jerusalem reestablished again as the capital? Basically, the name of the Father would have been put among the nations. The world should have recognized that Yahweh is true. But what did the Jews did when they returned? They did not establish the Torah as the constitution and the authority of the land of Israel. They used principles of the Torah. They used some of the commandments of the Torah as a cultural thing, but they did not use the whole Torah and the authority that has the proof, the legal binding covenant that shows us that the land is a contract and that the land was given by Yahweh, which it would have basically declared the authority of Yahweh on the land and the whole world. The whole world would have recognized that the God of Israel is true. But that didn't happen. They still keep the Sabbath and the feasts as national holidays, which they're still keeping the signs of the covenant. But they didn't fully institute the Torah as the full authority because of the religious system and the whole bound of religion and traditions that they so overwhelmed people with. They decided to keep one and two separate, a secular and a religious government. But what would have happened if the whole world, all the Jews all over the world, from America, from South America, from Central America, from Europe, from India, from Australia, from New Zealand, all of them would have gone to Israel in 1948. What would have happened? All the lawyers, all the doctors, all the bankers, all the politicians, all the rabbis, all the rich people that have been blessed among the nations would have taken their wealth. How about a transference of wealth, huh? That would have put Israel on the map as the number one country in the world in 1948 all the way through. They didn't return. Less than 10% of the world Jewish population returned. That's nothing new. It happened in the Persian Empire. When the Persian king, he gave the decree for Ezra to go back to the land. Ezra, he took a copy of that decree and sent it to Elam, which is modern-day Iran, and he sent it all the way to Assyria, where the 10 tribes were scattered. None of the 10 tribes returned, according to Josephus. Only 5%, less than 10% of the Jewish population and the Levites and the Benjamites who were in Persia, that used to be the ancient Babylonian, and also far east, where it's Kazakhstan, Afghanistan, Pakistan, North India, Kashmir. None of those returned, only less than 5%. Imagine if at that time, all of the Jews from all over the world, all of the Israelites too, the 10 tribes, would have returned to Israel and proclaimed the greatness and proclaimed Yahweh as the suzerain and the great king. So this is a pattern that our people do not return. They don't care about the land. I know many Jewish people in America that could care less and who's never been in the land of Israel. Ladies and gentlemen, if we are the kingdom of Yahweh and he is the king of the earth and he has given us a gift to return to the land of Israel, the moment we refuse the land, I'm talking about the people who have access, who have the right to go right now legally, and we don't. Like, for example, I am a son of the Benanuzim. The Benanuzim are the forced ones that were forced to convert from the Jewish Spanish Jews that were forced to convert to Catholicism. Now, my family, when I was born, I was never really Catholic. But my forefathers, my aunts, my grandmother, all those people that were forced, and they became basically Catholics. Once I found out who I was, I returned. But because I could not, then we had traditions in our homes that points us to Israel. But once I found out who I was, I returned. Do you know that Israel would not allow me to return because I don't have the papers? We didn't preserve because of the fear of being lost and the fear of being persecuted in the Inquisitions. Basically, my forefathers refused to continue us in the Torah and for fear of life. So they integrated within the Catholic Church, and then we lost our identity. But you see, God made a promise to Abraham. And I'm actually a descendant of the Levites. So what happens? God made a covenant with the Levites forever. It's a grant. So he called me from among the nations and gave me an opportunity to return to his Torah. I accepted it, and then he's given me the right to teach the Torah to the nations, which is the gift he gave us, the Levites, all the way from Mount Sinai. I'm basically working on my role. Now, many people do refuse and they don't care to go back to the land. Ladies and gentlemen, let me tell you something. Those Jewish people who can trace their lineage back, who can fulfill the requirement according to the law of the land right now, and refuse to go back to the land, They are basically, that is an affront to the promise and the gift that the Father gave Israel. See, the duty of every Israelite is to return to the land if they're able to. But the government does not want us, and the people who can go, they refuse to go. So now they're confronting the world with many, almost like 100 to 1, you know, 1.2 billion Muslims to 6 million Jews in Israel. What are the odds of those? You know, it's kind of, you know, it's very different. What about if the 45 Sephardic Jews were accepted to return? 45 more million in Israel, plus all the other 20 million Jews around the world. That kind of changes things a little bit. With all their wealth, with all their knowledge, with all their understanding, talk about a brain drain in the world. All the scientists, all the doctors, all of the judges, all of the lawyers, all of the politicians, all of the bankers, all of the everybody and their wealth, bringing it back to the land. What would happen? The whole world will have to recognize that Yahweh is God, and there's none other. But by us not returning to the land of Israel, and those who are able to legally refusing to return, is an affront to the king. Not recognizing his gift to us. And that's what I'm so passionate about, sharing with you what covenant really is. So the moment you have an opportunity that you can go to the land, that you go to the land and you believe in the covenant and you believe in the promises and you believe in the Torah and that you believe in his word by any means necessary. Now, in the meantime, we can go to the land legally and stay there. So what would be my option? My option is to go and visit. Take people to the land and show them and teach them in the land how awesome, how great, how exalted, and how reverent we should be and honor the King of the universe who provided so that we can go on eagle's wings and be in the land of Israel and to make a declaration that we will believe and stand. And then when we come back from Israel after a short visit, after spying out the land, 15 days of spying out the land, then when we come back, we'll bring a great report and let the whole world know that the land is fruitful and the land flourishes and that, yes, there are enemies in the land, but Yahweh's with us. We can take them. He will lead the way. He will defeat the enemy. Don't be afraid. Don't be afraid what CNN says. Don't be afraid what Fox News says. They're not God. We serve Yahweh. We serve the King of the universe. We are his servants. He promised he will follow through on it. You just stand on the promises and do not doubt on him. Let me move on here. And I'm going to show you another map that I've seen already show you many times all through our series of the ancient Near East. Okay? So it's a map of the ancient Hittite Empire, the Egyptian Empire, Mitanni, the Assyrian, and the Babylonian. Now remember that in the ancient world, that piece of land of Israel was a very important trade route for all the Levant, which is the Crescent Fertile. It's a very important piece of land. Okay? Now, the Father gives that land to Adam, which happens to become the number one trade route all to the ancient Orient and all the way down to Africa. Do you remember? Will you understand how significant that would be in trade? If Israel has a strong army and they're protected by Yahweh, no one can pass through that land unless they pay tariff or they pay taxes or they pay the fee to get through. In that time frame, that's how important the land was. That's why the Valley of Jezreel was so significant, so that it will be the passageway and the bridge from Asia or from Iraq and Iran and those places all the way down to the Nile River and the North Africa. Very important piece of land, all right? If we do not understand the history of that time frame or that land, we're not going to be able to really get this. This is the introduction to this particular teaching, so I'm going to go slow. If it takes me 2 hours to do it, great. If it takes me three, no problem. But I think it's imperative that we cover this area in a good way, cover this particular topic with time, so that we get a greater understanding how awesome, how exalted God is in his promises. Legal terms. Ancient Near Eastern terms that I need to review with you before we continue. Father. The expression father was what the vassal, the servant, calls their suzerain, their king. The word son is an expression that the king will call his vassals. So in the Bible, when you see that God talk about Solomon and he says, I am your father and you are my son. That is an ancient language of adoption. Now, why is this part of so important? Why am I mentioning these terms right now in context of the Grand Covenant? Because the moment he called David, for today I have begotten you in the Psalms, that's basically an adoption. That means that you are my appointed one. You are my king that I appointed on the earth. You are my prince on the earth. The word adoption is when a vassal king submits to the suzerain, when the vassal king's people become adopted by the great king. So now when Paul says that we are the sons of the living God, that we are the sons of Bnei Abraham, the sons of Abraham, we have been adopted into the family of Abraham. Paul is using a language that is no longer used in the modern day Judaism or in Christianity. You understand? This is very important. You with me? You following me? This is exciting, don't you know? Because now we're understanding a legal language that Paul is using that Christianity does not quite understand in the context of the ancient world. You see, because in the Tanakh, in the Torah and the prophets, the word adoption, as we know it, you and I, adoption, that word, does not appear. So how can you use the word adoption to talk about adoption? If you follow what I mean. Because the language in the ancient Near East was when a king called you my son and you call him your father, that's the expression of adoption. It's always existed, but back then they didn't know the Hebrew, the English word adoption. So now the word adoption is the equivalent of that legal language used in the ancient Near East. Now, the word brother. The word brother is a word that was used for parity covenant. A parity covenant is when somebody is of equal status and now you come into a covenant together so that you can have each other's interests. So if you're a king and I'm a king, I come into an equal, we're equal status, we're both powerful, and now I say, hey, let's come into a covenant, so if I have runaway slaves, you send them back to me, that we will help each other's border, that we will help each other, and then you will call each other brothers. Love, the word love, ohev, it's a term of loyalty towards our God. It means that we will be undeniable in our loyalty. We will be completely submitted to every decree that our king desires and wishes. And then the word no. The word no, yada, is the term used by a king when he recognizes the loyalty and the faithfulness of the servant. And that's why he calls Moses, I know you by name, Moses. Or that I knew Abraham will teach his children. When he uses that expression, he means that when he says, I want to know you, he says, I want to know your integrity. I want to know your character. I want to know you. I want to know who you are. I recognize who you are. That's why in the book of Hosea, which is written in the language of ancient Near Eastern covenants, it uses that expression. Okay, and you shall know that I am God. You'll know my integrity once I bring you back. Okay? And the word friend is a faithful, loyal to the king. So when a king calls you a friend, he is saying you're loyal to my authority. Okay, so another term of expression that we need to work on is the word those who hate me and those who love me. Okay, listen to how it reads in Exodus. You shall not bow down yourself to them nor serve them, for I, Yahweh Elohim, I'm a jealous Elohim, visiting the iniquity of the fathers on the children, on the third and the fourth generation, to those who hate me. Verse 6. And showing loving kindness to thousands of those who love me and keep my commandments. Now the word hate and the word love. Esau I hated, Jacob I loved. What does that mean in the ancient context? I'm going to read you a quote from the book, Legal Revision and Religious Renewal in Israel, by Bernard M. Levinson. It reads like this. Now, do you know the word the word hate and the word to love me? It was an ancient legal term. Quote, the Hebrew participles translated as those who love and those who hate or reject are not effective but legal terms. In other words, they're not just terms that, oh, I love you, let me give you a hug and a kiss. No, they were legal terms back then, reflecting the terminology of the Hittite, Neo-Assyrian, and the Aramaic state treaties. Love designates political loyalty to the great king, whereas reject or hate denotes act of treason. So when the Lord says, Esau, I hate it, he committed treason by giving away his inheritance, by married into the Canaanite woman and by married into the daughters of Ishmael. When Jacob was told to marry into the house of Haran, the house of Abraham, and he obeyed. So therefore, what we see are legal terms. If we don't recognize these terms, we're never going to see the significance of the love of Yahweh, the loyalty, the faithfulness that he has towards us. All right. Now, in the screen, what you see now is a picture of King Solomon kneeling down on a platform near the altar. And I want you to pay close attention to that picture, because this is an example of ancient vassal, suzerain, king submission. In King Solomon, when he dedicated the temple, he put a platform near the altar. He knelt down and he raises up his hands. And then he did a most beautiful prayer to the Creator, accepting him as his master, Adonai Elohim. If you read the Hebrew version of that prayer, you're going to see that he uses the word Adonai quite a lot. He is saying, my master. He is recognizing that the God of Israel, he is his king, that he is submitted to him. That's why the kings of Israel were given a Torah. They must write a Torah. Why? Because by writing the Torah, you recognize that you are loyal only to him and nobody else. The duties of the kings of Israel was to bring the whole world into submission to the great king, to pay tribute to the great king. That's the whole idea. That's why in the book of Zechariah says that all the nations that are left, that survive the great judgment, then they will go up to Jerusalem to bring tribute, to celebrate tabernacles, where you will bring the last in gathering, the first fruits of your harvest. So therefore now you will give it to the king and you will worship and praise him there. The feast, that's what it's all about. So why is the fire what came down from heaven? Now remember that fire is prevalent. Excuse me. That fire is prevalent in the Bible. When Solomon dedicated the temple, the fire came down from heaven. When Moses dedicated the tabernacle, the fire came down from heaven. That fire led them in the wilderness, pillar of fire. When Elijah set up the altar for Yahweh and the prophets of Baal set up their own altar, which one the fire came in? On the one Elijah set up. You know what that means? That when the fire came down on that altar, that represents that Yahweh had just endorsed Solomon as his appointed one. That he just said to everybody, this is my leader. This is the one that I've endorsed. I endorse this house. I endorse his kingship. I'm behind him 100%. That's what happened in the book of Exodus. Every time they raise up against Moses, you notice that Moses always hit the deck. You know, Moses was always on his face. Every time they spoke wrongly against Moses, he hit the deck. He's always like, oh Lord, have mercy on him. Why? Because Moses understood. Remember who Moses was? Moses was raised in the house of Pharaoh. He understood the protocol of how you honor the great suzerain. The Pharaoh in Egypt was one of the greatest power on earth at that time. It's like saying America and China, the leadership. So if you will speak against Pharaoh, that is treason. Or if you speak against any leader that Pharaoh positioned there, then it's treason against Pharaoh. You see it in the story of, let me show it to you so you see what I mean. In the story of Genesis 41, the exaltation of Joseph, I want you to listen to the language. In verses 43, says, and he had him ride on the second chariot, and which he had, and they cried out before him, bow the knee. So he sat down all over the land of Egypt. Watch this, it's important. Pharaoh also said to Joseph, I am Pharaoh, and without your consent, no man may lift his hand or foot in all the land of Egypt. So what does that mean? Now that I understand this, it means that if anyone will speak against Joseph, it's as if you speak against Pharaoh. That's why Yeshua says, if you hate me, you hate the Father. Because if he is the appointed one by Yahweh, then if you speak wrongly against Yeshua, it's as treason to the Father who appointed him. Something that happened in the politicians, this, you know, like the gentleman who's running for the Republican nomination right now to be president, he went to Europe and he went to Israel and they would ask him about the policies in America, and he will not speak against the president of the United States. He speaks about his agenda if he becomes president, but there is an unwritten rule that basically you don't go to another country to speak bad against your president. And you know, they still understand this protocol. And even though he doesn't agree with the president of this country and he's running against them, in America, there is an open game to call him out on what he's doing wrong. But in the around the world, he's not doing that. He would not speak against the president of the United States. So why is it that in this world, human beings honor someone even though they don't agree with them in the eyes of the nations? But we serve the great king of the universe, and there's people in the Hebrew Roots movement rejecting Yeshua and speaking wrongly against Yahweh. We need to repent. We need to stop rebelling, and we need to stop doing the imagination of our hearts. We need to return to the ancient path and to walk according to the statutes of our king, ladies and gentlemen. This is very important. All right, let me continue. So there are major types of oral covenant. Let me review this again. I already covered this in the beginning, but I want to cover this again. Treaties in the ancient Near East. You have the suzerain vassal treaty, right? Then you have the royal grant. And that's the one we're going to focus on. And we also have the parity covenant. And then you have the gift of the land, the kingdom, and the priesthood. But then remember that we're going to cover this with the first century writings and the gift that Messiah will give us because God told him to. Okay, we're going to cover that in more detail in the rest of the teaching. Now, the royal grant is an unconditional grant. A king's grant of land or some other benefit to a loyal servant for faithful and exceptional service. The grant was normally perpetual and unconditional. But the servant's heirs benefited from it only as they continue their father's loyalty and service. Now, I want you to think about what I just said, because later on I'm going to make a statement here that is going to make sense to us in understanding the benefits of the land. Okay? I'm going to read it to you in a little while. Suzerain vassal treaties. In regards to treaty. Now, this is legal terms, okay? In a suzerain vassal treaty, or a great king and the servants, the treaty constitutes an obligation. Okay? An obligation of the vassal to his master. In other words, if you're serving a great king and you submit to him, then the treaty is basically based on my obedience to that treaty. I'll receive the blessings based on my obedience. Now, in the grant covenant, it changes. In a grant covenant, the grant constitutes an obligation of the master to his servants. And that's why in Israel, when the soldiers of Israel are at war, even if they believe in Yeshua or not, or even if they serve God in Israel or not, the moment they dress up in the uniform and they begin to defend the land and the integrity of Israel and the security of Israel, they're really defending the integrity of the one who gave the land. They're not just fighting for the people. They are fighting for the land and the one who gave it and the integrity of the one who gave the land. That's why they start praying, "Blessed are you, Lord our God, God of our forefathers, God of Abraham, God of Isaac, God of Jacob, the great and awesome God, supreme God, who bestows beneficial kindness and creates everything, who recalls the kindness of the patriarchs and brings a redeemer to the children's children for his name's sake with love. O King, Helper, Savior, and Shield. Blessed are you, O Lord, Shield of Abraham." Remember that in Genesis 15, when he is, that's a direct prayer in reference to the land of Israel. It says in chapter 15, verse 1, "After these things, the word of the Lord came to Abram in a vision, saying, 'Do not be afraid, Abram, for I am your shield. I am your great reward.'" That means that the moment they pray in the name of the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, now the great God who gave the land to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob must stand up. Because according to the ancient legal terms of the grant, is the duty of the master, right, to protect the servant, which is Israel. And we know that Israel is a servant of the great king. Amen. I want to see how much time I still have left. I have a few more minutes that I want to cover this, and I want to be able to cover it a little bit more, so just bear with me. We're going to cover about curses right now, and oath. a little bit, and then we're going to stop in part one, and we're going to continue our teaching on the Grand Covenant. So, but let me touch on little curses in the ancient covenants and what it means. In a suzerain vassal treaty, the curse is directed towards the vassal who will violate the rights of the king. Right? So if that's why you have curses and blessings in the book of Deuteronomy. Why? Because if the condition of being submitted to the great king is that he give you stipulations, give you covenant, the laws in order to you walk in line to keep the covenant, and then the blessings, if you do everything correctly, he'll give you the blessing. The curse comes if you disobey those conditions that he gave you. But if you willfully disobeyed it, it was death. Rebellion was not tolerated in the camp. This is a governmental structure. So in a suzerain vassal treaty, in the treaty, the curse is directed towards the vassal who will violate the rights of the king. Now, what changes in the grant, in the grant treaty is this. Check this out. In the grant, the curse is directed towards the one who will violate the rights of the king's vassals. Oh, let me explain this a little bit. Let me give you a quote and an example from the ancient Near East, and then I'll give you my own personal opinion. A peculiar threat occurs in an old Babylonian grant from Hana. Okay, that was an ancient king. Quote, whoever challenges the gift, his head will be covered in hot pitch. So what it's saying is that if a king gives you a gift, if you disobeyed, if your children disobeyed the covenant that you established with that king, they will be punished because of their disobedience to the covenant, but no one can take away the gift that the king gave his father. Very important. Because now Yahweh gives us the gift of the land to all of Israel forever, and we've been exiled among the nations for our disobedience. But he needs to bring us back because according to the ancient laws, once he gives you a gift, no one can take away that gift. Why? Because in the ancient world, the gifts were eternal, and the ancient suzerain vassal treaties, according to the laws of the ancient Near East, were perpetual. So the difference is that all those kings died and their gods are not real. But now our God, Yahweh, he showed up. And he established a covenant. And because he is sovereign God over the whole universe, when he brought the children of Israel back to the land in 1948, he declared his sovereignty on the earth, again. And basically now it should have been a rejoicing around the whole world to declare who he was. Let me give you another example. In the book, Essential Papers of Israel and the Ancient Near East, edited by Frederick Greenspan, and this is a teaching by Moshe Weinfeld. You can find the article on my website. Let me read you what it says in regards to the Grand Covenant. Okay, I'm going to start it here and then I'll read you the whole quote. Thus we read in the treaty of Hattusilis III, which with Ulmitesuv of Datasa says, quote, after you, your son and grandson will possess it. Nobody will take it away from them. If one of your descendants sins, the king will persecute him at his court. Then he is found guilty. If he deserves death, he will die. But nobody will take away from the descendants of Ulmitesuv either his house or his land in order to give it to his descendants of somebody else. These are legal terms and the laws of the ancient world. They use biblical principles that were established in Genesis to establish governments. Let me continue reading here. In a similar manner, Marsilius II reinforces the right of Capuntacal to the house and the land in spite of his father's sins. A similar wording occurs in the royal decree of Tukthalias IV, and Puduhepa from the descendants of Sahurunuwas, the Hittite high official. There we read, quote, nobody in the future shall take away this house from Umanaba or Teshub Menaba, her children, her grandchildren, or her offspring. When any one of the descendants or Umanabam provokes the anger of the kings, whether he is to be forgiven or whether he is to be killed, or one will treat him according to the wish of his master, but his house they will not take away, and they will not give it to somebody else. And where do you find that? You find that in the ancient deed, about El deed from Alala. Okay, you find all this. Basically, let me read you what it says right here, quote, "She shall not give anything from the inheritance to strangers." This is a compared the deed of Elephantine quoted above. So what we see here is all legal terms that we need to remember. If we do not remember these legal terms, if we don't recognize this, we're not going to see how significant it is for us to return to the land. And then we're not going to understand the book of Jeremiah, the book of Ezekiel, the book of Habakkuk, all the prophets trying to get Israel to repent, to return. Because even though Yahweh brought judgment upon Israel for not obeying the commandment, and when I come back on the second part, I'm going to tell you what those are. It has to do with the Sabbath. It has to do with the laws of Shemitah, which is the seven-year rest of the land, and the Jubilees. And those were the reasons why the Lord expelled Israel from the land. Even idolatry, we know that. But all of those together has a lot to do with why the children of Israel were dispersed. We're going to stop here right now. We're going to come back for part two of the teaching, the Grand Covenant of Israel given by Yahweh. So bless you. Please return. And we're going to have more to cover for you. Shalom.